On this particular day, there was a spring sun, the warm sun. A friend of mine would tell us that this particular sun that you would put your face up into and just want to keep it there. And if you did that, you'd remember every one of your teenage summers that were great. And that did work. I was on my way to my first admission on my part-time nursing gig for home health, which at the time was exploding. My territory was the Pocono Mountains of Pennsylvania, so I had nice two-lane roads, beautiful country, good scenery, that warm sun, blue sky, and my tunes were cranking loud. I found my patient's house, and it turned out he lived right on a lake, which I always wanted to do. I pulled into his parking area, and I got out, and I looked down, and his house was probably about 30 yards from the parking area, had a really quaint red brick path that was dissecting his lawn. Past the house, you could see the lake and the light shimmering on it. And I stood there thinking, this is like Eden, and I'm getting paid. So as I started walking down that red brick path, the door opened. And there was this gentleman in his late 80s. He had about a three-day stubble on a beard. He was wearing the biggest knit sweater I ever saw. He could have had three of them in it. He's like 5.5 feet tall, but he has the thickest shock of white hair I'd ever seen. I was immediately jealous. And he asked me into his house with the butler motion. You know, he extends his hand and smiles. I came in, set my stuff down, started my talk, who I was, where I came from, what was going to happen, how it was going to proceed, and I turn around, he's gone. He's just gone. So I tried to think about the notes back at the office about dementia. I didn't remember any. Went looking for him, and I found him in the next room. He was standing looking at 3 8x10 framed photographs that were on the wall. Without turning to me, he said, "That's my wife. She's been gone a long time." I didn't know what to say, so I said, "Are they your children?" There was a really long pause. It was very uncomfortable. I thought I made him emotional. No. He turned around and looked at me and he said, No. They're perfect strangers whose pictures I had taken, had them professionally framed, and I keep them on the wall next to my dead wife." He shook his head, and I mentally crossed dementia off that list. We went in the kitchen, and we started what I can only describe as a dance. It lasted over 4 hours for a procedure that should have been about 90 minutes. I would do an assessment or ask a question, then he would ask a question. After I answered, he would give me the exact same information about himself. And we talked about ourselves, our jobs, where we grew up, our wives, our parents, their heritages. What was the generation that first came to America? We covered it all. And finally, he said, "I'd like to show you something." So we walked through his house, and on the lakeside, there's a porch. And it's all screened in, and it's cozy, and the lake is out there. It's a beautiful view. He points to an overstuffed chair on the porch, and it's got little tables around it. It's got magazines and books and old coffee cups. And he said, "That's my favorite place in the world, and that's where I'm going to die." Now, this gave me pause, because at this time, we're going back far enough that the right to self-determination for a patient didn't exist. You now can say, "I don't want that medicine. I'm not going to have therapy today. I don't want to be admitted to the hospital. I don't want to be coded. I want to sit at home and die." And if you're of a right mind, you have the right to make those decisions. Then you didn't. I knew this gentleman's future, and the best it could be was he was going to be a 72-hour psychiatric hold that day. The worst, he's going to be tied down to a bed. So I asked him, "Sir, you know, is this today you're going to do it?" He said, "Oh, no, not today." So I thought I'd dodge that bullet. We went back to the kitchen, and we continued our dance. Eventually, he got around to music. And he asked me if I liked music, and I told him I was crazy about music. I love it. So he said, "Do you like classical music?" And I said, "Classical music was the music that got me to love music." said, I want you to listen to something. It's only 3 minutes long. We went into the other room. Out of a cabinet, he pulled an old tape deck and he pushed play. And what came out was some of the most beautiful violin solo I had ever heard. It was 3 minutes long. I don't remember the melody at all. I can really remember the emotions it evoked. And when it was over, he said, that was me. I did that. That was my audition for the Philharmonic all those decades ago. I said, sir, that was great. And then I said, you know, we're almost done. All we have to do is review your medications now. Skip those, he said. I'm not going to take them. I started to explain medications and chronic illnesses. And he said, stop. I told you what I'm going to do. I'm going to go to my chair. I'm going to die. So he was back at this. So now I'm standing in somebody who has this kind of a plan. And at that time, the rule was, you didn't leave them. You got help to come to you. So I told him I did not have the authority to let this happen, that I had to call his doctor in my office. So I asked him if I could use his phone, because certainly there were no cell phones. No, he said, you can't. See, he had done this before, but when his lungs started to fill up with fluid, he got scared, he called an ambulance. But while he's in the hospital, he thought he knew what to do. He had the phone turned off. So now I'm standing in front of somebody who wants to die. They have a plan. They've attempted that plan and found a flaw. They fixed the flaw. This gentleman, his future, to me, is horrible. And then he said to me, listen to me, listen. There's nothing wrong with my mind. My wife's dead. My children are dead. My friends are dead. I can't play the violin anymore. My fingers don't do what I want them to do. He said, I don't know anybody that lives around me. They took my car keys. They took my driver's license. He said, I'm trapped in a prison of memories. I'm old. I'm tired. I don't want to do it anymore. You know, and at that moment, I thought, he has the right. He should have the right. I realized this guy wasn't talking to me because he was lonely. He didn't find me interesting. He was trying to be a memory to someone. He wanted to leave proof that he existed. And right at that moment, I thought, you know, he earned that right. And I think he saw the conflict because he kind of took me by the elbow and he gave me that sweeping motion again. This time it was toward the back door. And we got to the back door and he shook my hand and he said, thank you, thank you. I walked out the door and started back up that brick path on a completely different day than when I came in. But as I walked up, the gravity of the decision that I made, that I had no power to make, was pressing down on me, and my heart's starting to beat so hard and so fast. I know I don't have the right to let somebody die. This is not my call. I have to do something. This will be my license. I get to the car. I toss the bag in the car. I turn around and go back to the house. I get to the top of that red brick path. I look down, and he's still standing in the doorway. And he looked up at me. Broad smile, raised his hand, and waved. So I raised my hand and waved. And then he took a step back and closed the door. Thank you.